Okay, great. Sorry about that little delay. As you might have gathered, this is going to be quite an old-fashioned presentation. So my only aids are chalk, blackboard, and handouts. I hope that's okay. All right, so consider the following principle for epistemic justification. If one has justification for believing P, and one has justification for believing Q, then one has justification for believing P and Q. This is sometimes called conjunction closure, because if it's right, then the set of propositions that one has justification for believing at any given time is closed under the operation of taking conjunctions. This principle goes by other names too, agglomeration, adjunction. And I think this can be described as a formal or logical principle, because really it only features a justification operator and logical constants, in this case, conjunction. In fact, I think this principle could be written out as an inference schema in a modal logic, with a single modal operator J to be read, one has justification for believing M. And in fact, if you do that, it looks like this, right? So from JP and JQ, you can conclude J, P, and Q. Now, that inference, as it happens, is actually valid in any so-called normal modal logic. Now that, however, is no reason for accepting the principle, but I think there are reasons for accepting the principle. Actually, I think it's quite intuitively compelling, at least at first, that if you have justification for believing this and justification for believing this, you have justification for believing this and this. Now, this principle has been the subject of considerable discussion amongst epistemologists. But apart from this principle and a few other closure principles, which are sort of in a very similar neighbourhood, logical principles for justification feature relatively little in contemporary epistemology. So I suppose theories of epistemic justification are usually assessed by exploring their predictions about hypothetical cases, right? So this kind of method is very familiar. You imagine some sort of case, and you try to elicit some kind of judgment about whether justification is present or absent in that case, and then you look at what the different theories predict, and you assess the theories that way. It's much less common for theories of epistemic justification to be assessed by exploring their predictions about logical principles, like conjunction closure. And I think undoubtedly one of the reasons for this is just that there are so few logical principles that are on the table in contemporary epistemology. But I think that epistemologists are really missing a trick here. There's a kind of an untapped potential here, I think. These closure principles are really only a very small sample of the logical principles for justification that we might consider. And what I want to do in this paper today is outline a bunch of further principles, well, the ones you can see on the board there, some of which I think justification ought to satisfy and some of which I think justification ought not to satisfy. So that's actually my primary aim, is just to kind of get these principles out there, to put them on the table, and to kind of portray them as an extra resource for evaluating theories of epistemic justification. I will also, if I have time, try and draw some tentative conclusions about the viability of some different theories. So I'll see how some different theories actually pan out when it comes to considering these logical principles. Okay, so that's the plan. Before I set out these principles and explain them, I might start off just by giving some of the philosophical background that led me to consider these logical principles. Now, I don't think this is really necessary to understand the principles. I don't think it's necessary to evaluate them either. I mean, they kind of stand on their own. But I think it might be useful just to give a little bit of context. Okay, so that's what I'll start off by doing. So in previous work, in my book, I've opposed a widespread view of epistemic justification that I've dubbed the risk minimization theory. What this view says, roughly, is that one has justification for believing a proposition P just in case it would be unlikely, given one's evidence, for P to be false. And I've put forward an alternative, which might sound quite similar at first. One has justification for believing a proposition P just in case it would be abnormal, given one's evidence, for P to be false. Now, those theories put like that do sound very close. And in a way, I think they are very close because they will make the same predictions about a broad range of hypothetical cases. In other ways, though, these theories are not at all alike. And actually, focusing on the logic of justification is one way to bring out how deep the gulf between these theories really is. Okay, but let me see if I can explain the theories a little bit more. So here's a very stock standard example. Suppose I wander into a room, I've never been in the room before, and I notice that the wall before me appears to be red. So that's my evidence. Wall appears to be red. Given this evidence, it's very likely that the wall is red. I hope you will agree. So for a risk minimization theorist, there's got to be some probability threshold, 0.9 maybe, 0.95, 0.99, at which a proposition is deemed unlikely to be false and you get justification for believing it. So I think wherever we set the threshold, we'd probably want to say, in a case like this, that it would be unlikely for the proposition that the wall is red to be false. But would it also be abnormal for this proposition to be false? Well, I think to describe an event or a situation as abnormal can obviously mean a number of different things. There might be a number of different things you have in mind with such a description. But I think that what we often intend to do is to mark out an event or situation as a deviation from some sort of pattern or default, and as something that would require special explanation if it were to occur or come about. So if the wall appears to me to be red, but it isn't red, then there would have to be some special explanation as to how this came to be. Maybe I'm having some kind of colour hallucination. Maybe the wall is white and illuminated by hidden red lights. Whatever the truth, I mean, it can't just so happen that the wall appears to be red and isn't, and that's all there is to say. I mean, that's not the kind of thing that can just so happen. There has to be more to the story. So in this case, both the risk minimization theory and this alternative normic theory, let's call it that, will predict that I have justification for believing that the wall is red, but they offer different accounts of why that is. And generally speaking, if the falsity of a proposition is unlikely, then I think the falsity of that proposition would also be abnormal in this sense of calling for special explanation, and vice versa. At any rate, these properties do seem to go together in most of the examples that epistemologists have tended to focus on. But they don't invariably go together, as will soon become clear. Now, on the risk minimization conception, conjunction closure fails, right? So to bring our conjunction closure principle back into play, if you're a risk minimization theorist, conjunction closure will fail. That's a familiar point, and the reason is also very familiar. The probability of a conjunction can be lower than the probability of either conjunct. And as such, the probability of the conjunction can dip below our threshold for justification, even if the probability of each conjunct exceeds it. Here's a simple example. Suppose three friends of mine, Jen, Bruce, and Maud, have each said that they're going to be coming to the office Christmas party. And I know that they're all really reliable people. You know, their word is good. As such, the proposition that Jen will attend, the proposition that Bruce will attend, and the proposition that Maud will attend are each really likely, given my evidence. Let's say they're each 95% likely. And suppose, finally, that I know that these propositions are probabilistically independent of one another. So the probability of any one of these people attending is not affected by whether either of the others attends, right? So completely independent. So then, according to the risk minimization theory, what do I have justification for believing? Well, for ease, let's set our threshold at 0.9, right? So I have justification for believing all and only those propositions that, given my evidence, are more than 90% likely to be true and less than 10% likely to be false, okay? Well, in this case, I will have justification for believing that Jen will attend, and for believing that Bruce will attend, and for believing that Maud will attend, because each of those propositions is 95% likely, so higher than the threshold. Now, it happens that I also have justification for believing that Jen and Bruce will attend, and for believing that Jen and Maud will attend, and for believing that Bruce and Maud will attend. Each of these propositions will have a probability of 0.95 squared, so that's 0.9025, still above our threshold. However, I will lack justification for believing that Jen and Bruce and Maud will attend. The probability of that proposition is 0.95 cubed, which is about 0.86, right? So below our threshold. So clearly, these predictions are at odds with conjunction closure. So I've got justification for believing Bruce will attend, justification for believing Jen will attend, justification for believing Maud will attend, justification for believing Jen and Bruce will attend, Jen and Maud will attend, Bruce and Maud will attend, but I do not have justification for believing Jen and Bruce and Maud will attend. Now, if we pushed our threshold value to 1, then we're no longer in risk minimization territory, right? We then would have on our hands a risk elimination theory of justification, or an infallibilist theory, in effect. And on this theory, conjunction closure would be assured, because if P has a probability of 1, given my evidence, and Q has a probability of 1, given my evidence, then it follows that P and Q will have a probability of 1, given my evidence. So interestingly, if we're kind of in this mindset of assessing theories of justification by exploring their predictions about hypothetical cases, well, infallibilism is usually thought to fare particularly badly there. It just doesn't give us justification often enough. It's too stingy. But if we kind of shift perspective and put these logical principles front and center when it comes to evaluating theories of justification, infallibilism immediately seems to do better. It actually gives us this nice intuitive logical principle, which the risk minimization theory, kind of paradigm fallibilist theory, does not give us. So I think that's quite an interesting observation in itself. But infallibilism is not the only theory which will deliver conjunction closure. What about the normic theory? Well, given Jen's reliability and her commitment to attend the party, it would be abnormal if she failed to show up, and some explanation would be needed. You know, she's ill, her car broke down, there was a family emergency, etc. And the same goes for Bruce and for Maud. So the normic theory predicts, just like the risk minimization theory, that I have justification for believing that Jen will attend, justification for believing that Bruce will attend, and justification for believing that Maud will attend. But it also predicts that I have justification for believing the conjunction. Jen and Bruce and Maud will all attend. Because look, if that proposition is false, then at least one of the three must fail to attend, right? That's the only way the proposition can be false. Whoever it is that fails to attend, they committed to attending and they're reliable, so some explanation is needed. Illness, car trouble, family emergency, etc. So the normic theory is not an infallibilist theory, not by any means, but its predictions are consistent with conjunction closure, at least in this case, though I think more generally, though I'll come to that. So conjunction closure is a special instance of the principle of deductive closure, right? Which says roughly that if you have justification for believing each of a bunch of things, then you must have justification for believing their deductive consequences. Okay, so conjunction closure is a special instance of that. Now, my impression is that philosophers tend to take very different, almost diametrically opposed views about these closure principles, like deduction closure, deductive closure, and conjunction closure. Some philosophers almost seem to regard these principles as sacrosanct, constraints that any adequate theory of justification must satisfy. And for philosophers kind of coming from this starting point, I suppose the example that I've just sketched would constitute a powerful objection to the risk minimization theory. But then other philosophers take a very different view. They seem to think that, well, it's just wrong to kind of trust your gut reaction to a principle like that. Really, you can't make an informed judgment until you have an adequate theory of justification to guide you. So from this kind of perspective, the failure of conjunction closure is just a kind of a result, maybe a somewhat surprising result, but just a result and not an objection to the risk minimization theory. So I'm not going to attempt to resolve this dispute here. In fact, I really I don't know how it can be resolved. I mean, it seems very much like a kind of a deadlocked dispute. But what I do think is that conjunction closure is not the only principle that's at stake here, and indeed not the only principle that's at stake in this example. So many epistemologists have been attracted to some version of the following idea. If one has justification for believing a proposition P, then one also has justification for using P as a premise in one's practical and theoretical reasoning. Let's put practical reasoning to one side and focus just on the theoretical, right? So the idea then is that whenever one has justification for believing a proposition, one can justifiably treat it as another piece of evidence in the service of drawing further conclusions and justifying further beliefs. And I think that many who put this claim forward, I guess this is just my impression again, but I think that many who put this claim forward regard it as something that precedes substantial theorising about justification. So something that delimits the notion that we're after, right? Now, what does this have to do with the present example? Well, look, according to the risk minimisation theory, I have justification for believing that Jen will attend, but I do not have justification for believing that Jen and Bruce and Maud will attend. But if I could simply add the proposition that Jen will attend to my stock of evidence, and why not? After all, I've got justification for believing it, then I would have justification for believing that Jen and Bruce and Maud will attend. With the independence assumption in place, the probability that Jen and Bruce and Maud will attend, given my evidence and the proposition that Jen will attend, is 0.9025, so above our threshold. So consider the following principle then. If one has justification for believing P, and one's evidence along with P provides justification for believing Q, then one has justification for believing Q. So I think this principle has a good claim to regimenting the idea that when we have justification for believing a proposition, we also have justification for using it as a premise in our theoretical reasoning. And if we accept the risk minimization theory, then not only do we have to give up conjunction closure, we have to give up this principle as well. And I actually think that this is another logical principle for epistemic justification, though not one that can be written down in a monadic modal logic. I'll come to that soon. So my original interest in this principle owed very much to the fact that it clashed with the risk minimization theory, right? I was interested in ways of undermining the theory, and this seemed like ammunition, right? So that's really what kind of piqued my interest in the principle. And I kind of thought that rather than trying to weigh into this deadlocked dispute over conjunction closure, maybe I could use a principle like this to outflank the risk minimizers, right? Attack them from another side. Anyway, that seemed like kind of an appealing idea to me at the time. Whatever you think about the prospects for that, I think these present considerations naturally arouse our curiosity as to whether there are any other logical principles against which the risk minimization theory, the normic theory, infallibilism can be tested. And indeed, I think there are. So I turn to that next. Now, before I go any further, I need to get two assumptions on the table. These are assumptions that will significantly expand the range of logical principles for justification that we can write down. The first of these is a kind of evidentialist assumption to the effect that one's justificatory status is a function of one's evidence, one's total evidence. So what one has justification for believing is determined by the evidence that one possesses. And the second is what's sometimes called a kind of propositionalist assumption. This is the assumption that one's evidence consists of a stock of propositions or a conjunction of propositions. What's liberating about these assumptions is that once they're in place, the justificatory relation between a subject and a proposition can be analysed in terms of a relation between propositions. So what it is for one to have justification for believing a proposition is for the propositions in one's evidence to provide justification for believing it. So with these assumptions in place, justification is best captured not by a monadic modal operator like this, but by a dyadic modal operator. In effect, an intentional condition. That's what this is. Now, you might think, well, hang on. This evidentialist assumption, this propositionalist assumption, aren't they kind of contentious? Isn't there a lot of literature out there on evidentialism and propositionalism about evidence? Indeed, there is. I'm not going to say anything more about these assumptions now. Of course, I'm happy to talk about them in the question session. Well, I'll say just one thing, and that is that in order for these assumptions to play their present role, the role that I have in mind for them, I think it's sufficient that they be taken in actually quite a minimal way. They don't really have to be taken in a very substantial or loaded way. Okay. But I'll leave it at that for now. All right, so we have this principle. If one has justification for believing P, and one's evidence along with P provides justification for believing Q, then one has justification for believing Q. So given the evidentialist and propositionalist assumptions, the three components of this principle actually turn out to have exactly the same logical form, the two premises and the conclusion. So if we let E be the conjunction of propositions in one's evidence, then what the principle becomes is if E provides justification for believing P, which I write like that, and E and P provide justification for believing Q, which I write like that, then E provides justification for believing Q. Now, the conjunction closure principle, just as a brief aside, I mean, also corresponds to a kind of inference schema in this logic, right? It's this one. You know, if E provides justification for believing P and E provides justification for believing Q, then E provides justification for believing P and Q. I think the reason that this principle can be captured in the simpler formalism is just that the antecedent term is the same, right, throughout the schema. So in effect, what you can do is kind of condense the E arrow into a single operator, right? But that's not going to work here. It's not going to work for any of these other principles. Okay, but come back to this. So I think we might call this principle cumulative transitivity. And actually, that's a name that only makes sense once we see the principle written out this way. You know, so a simple transitivity pattern for justification would be this one, right? V provides justification for believing P, and P provides justification for believing Q, then E provides justification for believing Q. That principle, however, I think is not valid, right, given the intended interpretation of the arrow. Suppose this is the proposition that the wall is white, thanks, and bathed in red light, okay? So that gives you justification for believing that the wall appears to be red. And the fact that the wall appears to be red gives you justification for believing that the wall is red. But the fact that the wall is white and bathed in red light certainly does not give you justification for believing that the wall is red. So that's a nice counterexample to transitivity. It's no counterexample to cumulative transitivity, because the fact that the wall is white and bathed in red light and appears to be red does not give you justification for believing that the wall is red. Okay, so no counterexample to cumulative transitivity. So, you know, the intuitive motivation for cumulative transitivity, as I noted before, is that it's just plausible to think that if I have justification for believing a proposition P, then I also have justification for using that proposition as a premise in my reasoning, adding it to my stock of evidence. But of course, when I use this proposition, I have to use it within the context of my total evidence, including the evidence that provided my justification for believing it originally. If I were to ignore my previous evidence, then of course I might well be led astray by using this proposition in my reasoning. And it's for that reason that simple transitivity fails, but cumulative transitivity doesn't. Seems like a good principle. Now, interestingly, simple transitivity could be derived from cumulative transitivity if we could make use of this principle here, monotonicity. How does that work? Well, suppose we have this and this, then by monotonicity we can get this, and then by cumulative transitivity we can get this. So you kind of see how that works. If you have cumulative transitivity and monotonicity, in effect you have full transitivity. So if we want to keep cumulative transitivity, but we don't want to have full transitivity, then we have to give up monotonicity. But I think that's just as well, because there are compelling independent reasons for wanting to give up monotonicity. Monotonicity is clearly not a valid schema, given the reading of the arrow. And its invalidity is just a function of the fact that justification is defeasible, right? Just because a certain body of evidence provides justification for believing a proposition, it doesn't follow that an enriched or augmented body of evidence will do so. That's why monotonicity fails. But there's a bit more to say about this. The failure of monotonicity has, of course, been the subject of extensive investigation in non-monotonic logic. And in non-monotonic logic, a number of interesting weakenings of the monotonicity property have been described. And I've got two up on the board here called cautious monotonicity and rational monotonicity. And both of these schemas can be arrived at by kind of adding a premise to the basic monotonicity schema. Now, I think I won't worry about rational monotonicity now. I'll focus on cautious monotonicity. So what this principle says is that if E provides justification for believing Q and E provides justification for believing P, then E and P together will provide justification for believing Q. Is that a plausible principle? Well, consider this, right? If I have justification for believing P and Q defeats my justification for believing P, then I don't also have justification for believing Q, right? At the same time. Really, if we just kind of rearrange that a little bit, if I have justification for believing P and I have justification for believing Q, then Q does not defeat my justification for believing P. That's just the cautious monotonicity schema. And I think it seems like quite a plausible schema to adopt. I mean, I think if the schema fails, then it must be possible for me to justifiably believe this proposition in a way that's vulnerable to defeat by this proposition, and yet also justifiably believe this proposition all at once. But that kind of seems like a clearly irrational, incoherent, internally conflicted set of commitments. So I think cautious monotonicity does have a certain amount going for it. One more principle that I want to look at. Suppose that we know that an investigation can only have two possible outcomes, right? Either it's going to generate evidence E, or it's going to generate evidence F. And suppose I also know that evidence E provides justification for believing P, and I know that evidence F provides justification for believing P. Well, then it kind of looks like presumably I already have justification for believing P without actually needing to go through this investigation. I already have the evidence E or F, and it looks like that should be enough to give me justification for believing P if E provides justification for believing P and F provides justification for believing P. So let's try and make this a little bit more precise. If E provides justification for believing P and F provides justification for believing P, then E or F provides justification for believing P. Another initially plausible principle, I think. And this can clearly be written out as an inference schema in our logic, and it looks like this. And that is sometimes called amalgamation, that schema. So if amalgamation is right, then the set of propositions that can justify a given proposition is closed under the operation of taking disjunction. So you can also think of this as a kind of closure principle, but a sort of reverse closure principle in a way. And amalgamation is in a certain sense the flip side of the agglomeration or conjunction closure principle. This is a sort of satisfying connection between the two. Because if we hold the antecedent of a set of justificatory conditionals constant, then agglomeration just allows us to freely conjoin their consequence. Whereas if we hold the consequent of a set of justificatory conditionals constant, then amalgamation allows us to freely disjoin their antecedents. Okay, so those are the principles that I want to draw attention to. So in a way, that's kind of the meat of the presentation. So I think that these here are really plausible principles for justification, principles that justification might intuitively be thought to satisfy, whereas these two are kind of the bad guys. You might think justification really shouldn't satisfy those. Okay, so in the time I've got left, I'm going to look very briefly at the question of what do our different theories of justification predict about these different principles. How much time do I have left, Benoit? Okay. I'll do what I can within that time. Now, look, I mean, we already know part of the answer, right? We know that the risk minimization theory invalidates conjunction closure and cumulative transitivity. We've seen that in the Christmas party example that I described. What about the others? Well, it actually turns out that if you accept the risk minimization theory, every single one of these principles, everyone on the board, is invalid. Risk minimization does not validate any of these principles. So I've already described counterexamples to conjunction closure and cumulative transitivity. What about these others? Well, here's a simple example, right? Again, suppose we set our threshold at 0.9, right? We're risk minimization theorists, and our threshold for justification is 0.9. And then imagine an 11-ticket lottery. Fair lottery, single winner, it's been drawn, we don't know the result. Well, I'm justified in believing that ticket 11 has lost, because the probability of that is 10 on 11, which is slightly more than 9 on 10, which is our threshold. Now, if I were to discover that ticket 10 has lost, well, then I would no longer be justified in thinking that ticket 11 has lost. Because the probability that ticket 11 has lost, given that ticket 10 has lost, well, that's 9 on 10, which is exactly on our threshold, not above it. So that proposition is a defeater. The proposition that ticket 10 has lost defeats my justification for believing that ticket 11 has lost. But of course, I also have justification for believing that ticket 10 has lost, because that has a probability of 10 on 11, which is higher than the threshold. So this is exactly the structure that cautious monotonicity says can't obtain, right? I have justification for believing this, vulnerable to defeat by this, and I also have justification for believing this all at once. So that works as a counterexample to cautious monotonicity and to rational monotonicity as well. What about amalgamation? Well, actually, given time constraints, I think maybe I won't describe the counterexample to amalgamation. It's a little bit more complicated. So I'll kind of leave that as an exercise, if that's all right. Of course, I can talk about it in the discussion session. But amalgamation also fails on the risk minimization theory. All right. So as we've observed, if we push our threshold value up to 1, then in a way that kind of looks like a small change to the risk minimization theory. But of course, it leads to an enormous formal difference. This infallibilist theory is formally, logically, very different to the risk minimization theory. And actually, on the infallibilist theory, well, we've already seen that conjunction closure works on the infallibilist theory. Actually, cumulative transitivity will work, amalgamation will work, cautious monotonicity will work, and rational monotonicity will work. So actually, on the infallibilist theory, as I said, what looks like kind of a small change, you just kind of sneak your threshold up from 0.9 to 1, you get this big formal payoff, right? All these principles are now valid. But of course, most would just consider this sort of infallibilist view to be a complete non-starter. You know, so many of the things that we take ourselves to have justification for believing just don't seem to be made certain by our evidence. So you might think, well, look, okay, this infallibilist theory secures the logical properties for justification that we want, but it does so at the cost of mishandling almost every particular case. And you might even think there's kind of a sobering lesson here about using logical principles to decide on a theory of justification. You might think, well, actually, look how misleading it's turned out to be in this case. We have to let particular cases really be the ultimate arbiter when it comes to deciding on a theory of epistemic justification. But actually, this thought is a little bit too quick. For even if we do just restrict attention to logic and logical principles, infallibilism does not have an unblemished record, not by any means. For while it does validate conjunction closure, cumulative transitivity, cautious and rational monotonicity, and amalgamation, it also validates simple transitivity. Because if the probability of P given E is 1, and the probability of Q given P is 1, then the probability of Q given E is 1. So on the infallibilist theory, transitivity will be valid. And in a sense, it also validates monotonicity. If the probability of Q given E is 1, then the probability of Q given E and P will also be 1, provided that conditional probability is defined. So you also kind of get monotonicity. So really, there's a sense in which these two theories are actually quite crude instruments when it comes to these logical principles. Risk minimization, just none of them. Infallibilism, all of them. So while the risk minimization theory seems to fall short and leaves justification with too little logical structure, infallibilism just overshoots the mark, saddling justification with too much logical structure. What about the normic theory? Well, of course, my hope is that the normic theory is going to carve nature at the joints, as it were, right? So the normic theory will give you these ones and not those ones. Now, I do think that that is, in fact, the case, but I can't really make good on that claim without giving a more sort of formal development of the normic theory, which I won't attempt to do now. But I will conclude with just a couple of remarks about conjunction closure and amalgamation. Because actually, I think it's quite easy to see that these inference schemas will be valid on a normic theory without even needing to bring much formal machinery to bear. Right, so I'll kind of close on that note. So what the normic theory says, recall, is that I have justification for believing a proposition P just in case, given my evidence, the falsity of P would be abnormal in the sense of calling for special explanation. Well, then consider conjunction closure, right? Suppose my evidence E provides justification for believing P and justification for believing Q. So according to the normic theory, there'd have to be some special explanation if E were true and P were false, and there'd have to be some special explanation if E were true and Q were false. But what about P and Q? Well, if P and Q were false, then either P would be false or Q would be false, right? That's the only way that it can happen. So as such, there would have to be some special explanation if E were true and P and Q were false. And so the normic theory predicts that E provides justification for believing P and Q, right? So it makes conjunction closure a valid principle. And the explanation for the validity of amalgamation is again sort of similar. It's sort of the flip side. Suppose E provides justification for believing P and F provides justification for believing P. Well, according to the normic theory, there'd have to be some special explanation if E were true and P were false, and there'd have to be some special explanation if F were true and P were false. But what about E or F? Well, if E or F were true, then either E would be true or F would be true. That's the only way that it can happen. So as such, there would have to be some special explanation if E or F were true and P were false. And according to the normic theory, E or F provides justification for believing P. So I think that's kind of suggestive. I hope that's kind of suggestive. I haven't made good on the claim that the normic theory really does carve nature at the joints here, that the normic theory gives us all these other principles as well. I hope at least those remarks about conjunction closure and amalgamation sort of somewhat point in that direction. And of course, I'm happy to talk more about it in questions. So I'll leave it there.